Ruminant animals are the foundation of human civilization. And so for thousands and thousands of years, success and security was driven by one thing: how much grass.
Welcome to the Ranch Investor Podcast. I am your three-year host, Coulter DeVries, accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and accredited farm manager with ASFMRA. I'm excited to bring you the experts on a weekly basis to hear what's trending, what's happening, what's going on in Montana, Wyoming, the West, and ranches across the United States.
The Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
Let's just get started with who is Todd Churchill? What's your background? What's the starting story here, Todd?
Yeah. That can take an hour, but we'll do the short version. I grew up on a farm with a 500 head feedlot in near Moline, Illinois. My grandfather bought the farm, but he was an attorney and didn't really spend much time there. And my dad started spending his summers out there when he was 9 or 10. And the next door neighbor to the farm was an old cowboy from Colorado. Bought my dad a pony and a saddle and got him a job at the sale barn, running his pony up and down the alleys, moving cows. And my dad fell in love with horses, started showing and training cutting horses when he was a teenager. He took over the farm when he was 16, when it was, I think, 80 acres, and has been involved in some fashion in the cattle and farming business ever since. He actually went to law school as well. And has a law practice in Moline that my younger brother went to law school and joined him. So I grew up in a very ag-focused entrepreneurial family with horses, cattle, crops. But, you know, to me, agriculture was driving a tractor straight, dealing with sick cattle in a feedlot, and playing with vats of toxic chemicals. So I went to college in Minnesota and went into public accounting and really didn't expect to be involved in agriculture. There wasn't the way we did ag at the time. It wasn't particularly compelling for me. I didn't feel drawn to it. So I went to school at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, went into public accounting, and then after a couple of years there, left in 97 and started one of the first part-time CFO practices in Minneapolis. And because I was a farm kid, I ended up with a portfolio of food and ag clients. Didn't really plan on that. It was just what I knew. And so one of those in the late 90s was a startup meat processor called Lawrence Meats. Became somewhat famous or notorious because Michael Pollan devoted a whole chapter in the Omnivore's Dilemma book to the way that this processing plant was designed. Mike and Rob Lawrence they had bought out their parents' little locker plant like every small town in America had until maybe 10 or 15 years ago that, you know, processed a couple beef or pigs a day, had a deli, a catering business. But they had much bigger visions. They believed that there was going to be tremendous demand for very high quality, fresh meat processing for specialty meats, grass-fed beef, bison, pastured pork, organic meats. And nobody really built a plant that was designed, that was big enough to create a product that looked every bit as good on a retail shelf as anything coming out of the big players. But it was small enough to be flexible and responsive to the needs of what we call branded meat companies. And so I was kind of a consulting CFO there. We got that first 10,000 square foot plant built in 2000. And because I learned the niche meat business well, I had the opportunity to start one of the first grass-fed beef companies in the U.S., which is called Thousand Hills Cattle Company. That got launched in 2003 because I had a good friend who was an integrative physician in St. Paul, and he had a large concierge medical practice, and all of his clients, he was literally prescribing grass-fed beef to all of his clients. The problem was the quality was terrible, it was frozen. They had to go buy it from some farm somewhere in the, you know, you when you buy a whole animal, you never really know what you're getting. He said, if you can figure out how to do a very high quality grass-fed beef that was fresh, I can get you into the premium grocery stores in the Twin Cities. And we launched Thousand Hills in 2003, and it took off fast. We kind of caught the wave of popularity with grass-fed beef. But our focus was not convincing you that you should eat this beef because it's good for you. I only had to do that the first time. After that, I wanted to create a product that was such a great eating experience that it didn't matter if it was good for you or healthy. This was the steak. This was the burger you wanted to eat just because it was so darn good. So I had a lot of fun with that. We learned a lot, grew that business pretty well. By 2015, we were killing about 6,000 head a year, sold it to my business partner, who's still running it, still doing a great job with it, has kept that going. But by 2015, when I sold, the Australians had figured out that they'd been selling grass-fed beef for decades to the U.S. really cheap, because we import lean meat to blend with our fat trim coming out of feedlots. And that's how we make our 80% lean or 85% lean burger that Americans love. We actually can't produce that product. You know, people get mad because we're importing beef, but what most people don't understand is that our feedlots cannot produce a hamburger. It's too fatty. The grind coming off of a feedlot steer is going to be maybe 50 to 60% lean. Well, you can't make a burger out of that. It's too much fat. So we have to buy some lean meat from South America, Australia, New Zealand to blend with that fat trim to make the perfect burger, which is going to be 80 to 85% lean. So the Australians have been supplying the U.S. market that way for years. They just weren't getting credit for the fact that it was grass-fed. And because they have a national animal ID system, it was pretty straightforward for them to get all of their cattle certified grass-fed, and in many cases certified organic. And by 2015, my customers could buy Australian 100% grass-fed ground beef delivered to the West Coast, and at less than half of what I was selling mine for. Now, they couldn't get steaks because the steaks weren't very good, but the grind was pretty much indistinguishable. And so I decided it was time to sell and to do something a little different. Parallel to that, in the mid-90s, as a family, we decided to stop investing in farmland in Illinois. We paid, I think, $3,300 an acre for some land in 1993 and thought that was really expensive. You know, in hindsight, prices just kept on climbing. But we decided to start buying ranch land in Oklahoma and move our cutting horse business and our cattle business to Oklahoma. And so we've had a ranch and a pretty prominent cutting horse, quarter horse breeding program near Wayne, Oklahoma, just south of Oklahoma City, about 60 miles, since the mid-90s. I come from this family background that's very involved in traditional ranching and cutting horses and feedlot cattle and grain production. And then I've kind of taken a spin on it and tried to provide what I'm curious by nature. And so most people in the beef industry told me in the early 2000s that it wasn't possible to do high quality grass-fed beef. That grass-fed beef is always going to be tough and gamey and lean, and there's nothing you can do about it if you don't feed them corn.
I want to come back to this grass-fed. Let's stay on this for a minute. But first, since this is Ranch Investor, why Oklahoma?
Oh, well, if the goal is to win the National Cutting Horse Association for charity, it helps to be at the epicenter of that industry, which is the corridor from Weatherford, Texas, Fort Worth, up to Oklahoma City. We were looking for productive ranch land, not necessarily scenic ranch land. So there seems to be I don't know exactly what it is, but once men achieve a certain amount of wealth, there's something hardwired that's instinctual that we just have to buy a ranch. We have to own cattle and buy a ranch. And it doesn't really, it that transcends social classes. It transcends educational background. It is a really hardwired, deep, instinctual need to, there's a sense of security that I don't think we're even really conscious of. But it's a powerful driver. Once people have the means to do it, they want to own in some fashion a ranch that has cattle on it. And if you have the money, why not buy one that's also beautiful, that has some recreational value, that gives you incredible views? And those are typically going to be in the Intermountain West. We see ranch land in those markets increasing tremendously in value. But that value is completely decoupled from its operational productivity. Its value is driven by the fact that there will always be more people that have just recently acquired the wealth, and they feel compelled, for ways that they can't really explain or articulate, to buy a ranch.
And people will mortgage everything they have and live on the razor's edge, making at best $2,000 a month to own, control the land.
Correct.
And live out there. I wouldn't say own, because the bank owns it at that point.
Yeah.
But to have the illusion of control,
right,
and the lifestyle.
Correct. Correct. And, I tell clients all the time. So, my career has evolved. After selling Thousand Hills, I've had a consulting practice similar to the one I had before as a part-time CFO. But my focus now is on large ranch and farms. Merged that practice in with Clifton Larson Allen. We're the 8th largest CPA firm. I've been there for 3 years, and I run our outsourced accounting group. So I run the team of people that provide outsourced CFO, controller, and bookkeeper services for our large ag producers. Do a lot of work with ranches and farms and meat processors.
Well, that's going to be the next topic, is CFO work, your CPA background. You have enterprise analysis for QuickBooks, which comes up on this podcast a lot, and it comes up in my conversations with owner operators and lessee operators. And a lot of times, yesterday I had three big calls about this passive syndication investment that I'm working on.
Yeah.
And talking to people about the land as its own entity, as an investment, not as operating asset. These are generational operators, and you'd think I'm speaking Mandarin to them. They cannot, it doesn't translate that the land is a separate entity and it is an investment asset, not an operating asset. It's tough. That's a tough conversation.
It is.
To win people over with, because it's just so far out of their realm, because they're like, well, what about the principal? I mean, what about my principal payment and my equity? And you've always got there. That's not going to go anywhere. It's challenging.
Yeah, it is challenging, because we have a very intricate tax law that provides completely different rules for agriculture than for any other business. And so a lot of what is recommended by advisors, attorneys, CPAs, farm management consultants, is really designed to optimize for tax strategy, which is a good thing. But that seldom gets you a successful multi-generational result. If you truly want to have a multi-generational land investment, you have to be brutally honest with you. If you're never going to sell it, it doesn't matter how much the land is appreciating. Then what matters is you have to figure out how to use that land to create enough operating free cash flow that you can afford to pay your family members and other non-family members to operate it. And that is a very difficult thing to do. It's harder in the cattle business than any other part of the of agriculture, because the cattle industry is the only one, and nobody who achieves any significant wealth is compelled to go own a million chicken laying hens or chicken broilers in a barn in
Hollywood,
Arkansas.
Hollywood doesn't make movies about farmers.
No, they don't. There's nobody who achieves wealth goes and builds, you know, 30 sow barns. There's something about the pastoralist. I mean, ruminant animals are the foundation of human civilization. And so for thousands and thousands of years, success and security was driven by one thing. How much grass do you have access to? This is far before this predates any Greco-Roman concept of land ownership. How many ruminant animals can you manage? Because ruminants do this amazing thing that people, pigs, and poultry can't do. They turn solar energy stored and collected in a leaf of a plant into meat and milk, and they're mobile. Those two things that's why we have human civilization.
And they do it on non-arable lands.
They do it on, exactly. Because by definition, those leaves are growing in an environment where annual plants won't grow. We've already turned every possible acre, you know, around the world. If you can grow an annual crop, and because grain has some incredible advantages over grass. Grain is nature's solar energy battery. It stores extremely well. It transports well, and it's concentrated energy. Ruminants can feed us with just sunlight and water, but that grass, you have to be able to move to follow where the grass is, because grass isn't a reliable, grass doesn't grow the same place reliably, consistently year after year. So the moment that we adopt a personal property right mindset and we start building fences, now the success in life is not optimized by owning more cattle that you can move to wherever the grass is. Success is optimizing the production of the land that I control. And that inevitably leads us to grains instead of to ruminants. Because grain is always going to provide a long-term better security and a better return if I can grow it. And I don't have to be able to grow it every year, because grain stores so well.
Stores and markets very easily.
That's right. So so what's happened is that there's, in the cattle industry, you're always competing against people who will devote wealth they made in other ways to owning cattle. And that that doesn't happen in any other livestock sector.
That's like the old saying, never get into a business that so many are willing to do for free.
Right. That's exactly how it works. So the only real limit to the number of cows we have in the U.S. is drought. When everyone that owns cows, that owns ranches, will expand the cow herd if they have enough rainfall to grow enough grass to do it.
And this we're going to get into now, some technical. You have so many landowners who are thinking expansion, control of grass, as you said, mm-hmm. so that I can grow my herd. They're not thinking of internal expansion, though.
Right.
14 cross fences rather than buying 14,000 new acres. How about that?
Yeah. Right. We know from our work, I've been good friends with Dr. Alan Williams, who started Understanding Ag a number of years ago and leads the Soil Health Academy. With all of the ranchers that he's consulted with over the last 20 years, we know that anyone that changes their grazing management to adaptive multi-paddock grazing, essentially, we want to give all of our cattle only access to a small portion of our grass, graze it intensely for a short period of time, and then leave it and make sure they can't get back to that grass again until it's fully regrown. In 5 years, we've doubled the carrying capacity on every ranch, everywhere in the world. This works. And all we're really doing is replicating what ruminant animals instinctively do if there's no fences.
And does this play into the QuickBooks plugin that you have that was developed in New Zealand?
It does.
So my wife and I, we went on a honeymoon to New Zealand and we did a hot air balloon ride over the Canterbury Plains. And I'd always known that New Zealand was well ahead of the United States in grazing management, resource management for livestock, because they are an island nation and island nations are very volatile with their budgets as a nation. They're very dependent on exports. And I believe the story is that there came a day where New Zealand realized they were subsidizing their farmers too much. And they could not stand to bear that cost any longer, given they are an export nation with primarily one market, China, dry powdered milk going to China.
Correct.
And so all these rotational intensive grazing operations are mostly dairy down there. But from the view of a hot air balloon, you just saw all the pie slices over the center pivots. Every square foot of grass was optimized. Every farm was clean. You didn't see all the junk equipment. The boneyard out back. And I think that has a big piece of plays into subsidies. I mean, if you're not optimizing and maximizing your resources, you'll keep a boneyard of junk. And we all have those around farms and ranches because, I mean, in some way, the ability to keep that junk is subsidized by the United States taxpayers.
Oh, absolutely. It is. And, you know, subsidies has changed the game. And so New Zealand's a great, fascinating thing to study. What happens when you take away government subsidies? And for the last 25 or 30 years, I would say nearly all of the innovations in grazing have come, and genetics, polywire, high tensile electric fence, all of that has come out of New Zealand. So when you take away the subsidies, the innovation that's created is amazing, because you can't just exist. You have to figure out how to do something differently. And their environment, their unfair advantage worldwide as in agriculture is they have reliable rainfall and they have very limited temperature windows. So in Minnesota, it's going to be 30 below zero with a wind chill, probably 10 below zero real temperature. It could be 100 degrees in the summer. That's a 110 degree swing. In New Zealand, you might have a 40 or 50 degree swing. So with that predictability, you can grow grass extremely reliably. And grass is cheaper to grow than annuals. And part of the reason they don't have the equipment boneyards there is they've never built an equipment intensive ag industry that was focused on growing grains. They optimized for grass.
I don't know a lot about the QuickBooks plugin, but my assumptions are that it's an enterprise analysis. And we Americans are really bad, really bad.
We are bad at this. Yeah, we are. And this is really what drives my consulting work, is that if I'm working with a manufacturing company that makes metal parts for something, they're going to have, by the time they have a $10 million revenue business, they will have a pretty sophisticated understanding of what does it cost them for their raw materials, what does it cost them for their labor, what does it cost them for all their indirect costs. And they've put a lot of thought and years of trial and error into allocating all of those costs back to everything they make. So they know with great precision, down to a penny, or maybe even a fraction of a penny, what is their cost to make each part that they make. And they may have, they may make 600, 500,000 different items, and they know with pretty good precision what every one of those things cost them. And then you go into the farming world, and you have a $10 million business, and they all they have is a checkbook. It's cash basis because that's all that tax return is requiring. And they don't track their inventory. All they know is that my cash is either going up or going down. And the brutal reality is that U.S. commodity markets, grain markets, and certainly the cattle market, it will always always return, in terms of an average pay price, it will pay the average cost of production for the average producer. So it will pay enough to keep the average producer from quitting, but it doesn't pay them anything other than their cost of production.
That's what I've, you know, my commiserations with my generational owner operators. I'm fifth generation Montana rancher, by the way, Todd. And so my network, MSU and Class C schools, you know, your schools of less than 100 kids. A lot of good friends across Montana and Wyoming. And my general commiseration, because they love to call me and bitch about the weather, the markets, and the government. As they're leaving the FSA office, I think they're bitching about those three things. But my response is generally, well, if you operate conservatively, because you're in a commodity business, so it's a low cost leader. If you just operate conservatively, manage your risks, keep at it over the long term, you're going to be fine.
Right.
You're not going to become Jeff Bezos, but you're also not going to be a beggar on the street. You'll be fine.
Yep. The key is you have to stop evaluating your success based on your profit or your return per animal. And you have to evaluate it per acre. Your KPI is denominated in how much forage do you produce? How much return are you getting? So it's two things you optimize. One is how much forage can you produce? And two, how do you monetize that forage without selling it off your ranch's hay? Because all you're doing then is you're just mining the nutrients in your soil. And of course you're getting paid for those nutrients, but you're rarely even making enough to afford the replacement cost of those nutrients that you're shipping off.
What comes first, the chicken or the egg, the KPIs or the enterprise analysis?
Enterprise analysis comes first. The first thing that I when I walk through this with a client, the first thing actually is getting a commitment to have a disciplined financial review process. And that means that either monthly or quarterly, as your part-time ranch CFO, we are going to spend a couple hours talking about the business instead of about cows or land, or we're going to work on the business, not in the business. And Holistic Resource Management has done a great job with this. Ranching for Profit has done a great job with this. And we all say the same things. You got to think about this as an owner. You got to think about it like you owned a manufacturing business that you weren't emotionally invested in. You know, if you're the third generation to own a $100 million manufacturing business and you make car parts and you're only making $500,000 a year on $100 million in sales, you're going to look for other options. If somebody will pay you $100 million for your business, one times gross revenue, and you can go do something different, you're probably going to do that because you don't have that emotional investment. You can't have that conversation in ranching or farming because we have convinced ourselves that continuing to own this land and pass it down is the most sacred thing in our existence. And
mortgage the home for it.
Right.
Never mortgage
That's right.
the home 40.
That's right. And I have a great story. A friend of mine who's a client, on the day that his parents transferred the ranch to he and his wife, his dad said to him, "Congratulations." His mom said to his wife, "I'm so sorry." Because your life will be dictated completely by this all-pervading need to hand this off. And that's great. Being a steward is an awesome thing. It's a great and a noble calling. But what we do in, especially in the ranching community, is we're saddled with the burden of being a steward. And nobody teaches us the skills or the tools to be an effective steward. So I'm a big fan of managing what I've been given for the benefit of my kids and their kids. But that if all you do is give your kids the burden without the tools to manage it well, you're not helping anybody, and you're not actually doing anybody any favors.
In your experience, we're talking about some pretty serious paradigm shifts right now. One paradigm shift is that this is objectively, unemotionally a business. So I'm going to need you to get over your homesteader mentality that this is the legacy, that your blood, sweat, and tears are in the land.
I don't want you to lose that, because that's just part of who you can't just stop being who you are. That's who you are as a culture. It's who you are as a heritage. You know, all I want is for you to take an hour once a month and set that aside. You're going to pick it back up again.
So the next paradigm shift that I'm thinking about is, you're asking guys who, well, damn it, Todd, I'm a really good mechanic. I fix the tractors. I'm very good with animal science. I know my cows better than anyone. I'm a worker. I like to wake up at 5 o'clock and get right outside and come back home at about 6 or 7. I do labor very well. And now you're asking me to do some financial guru. I'm
asking you to
bullshit.
Think a little bit. Yep.
Well, so which is harder, the legacy or the technicality?
So to answer that, I always ask a question. Being human means that you wake up in the morning, you have to solve problems. That's you can't escape that. The question is, what kind of problems do you naturally want to solve? Do you wake up in the morning wanting to solve thing problems? I got a tractor that won't start. I got cows that need to be fed. I've got hay that needs to be made. I need to get the salt out. I need to go check water tanks. Those are thing problems. I'm going to go interact with my world in a tangible way, and I'm going to fix stuff. And I'm going to feel good at the end of the day because I got that kind of stuff done. Nobody has to tell me to do that. Nobody has to ask me to do it. I'm just going to do it. And then there's people problems. Some people wake up in the morning and they're excited about building better relationships with people. Those are going to be counselors and service workers and people that work in retail. You know, they wake up in the morning and they spend all day solving other people's problems. And then you have people that are wired to solve abstract problems. And this is where we run into problems, because you can't retain ownership. Ownership of land is really an abstract thing. And you can't succeed multi-generationally owning land if you haven't developed the skills or are hardwired to think that way. Ironically, Taylor Sheridan does a great job of showing this in Yellowstone, because it's not your skill as a cattleman that allows you to keep your ranch. It's your skill in understanding how ownership of a ranch is an abstract thing, and you really have to figure that out. Well, and now, you have to be able to separate it.
Now we are truly fair and balanced on this podcast, because you're the first one to come on and speak highly of the TV series Yellowstone.
There's actually a lot of truth about the ownership piece of it. Now, I think you always get some really interesting insights from smart people who didn't grow up in a multi-generational farming and ranching
You can see the forest because you're not in the trees.
Correct. Yep.
So one thing I'm thinking of with this enterprise analysis, this QuickBooks plugin that you have from New Zealand.
Yep.
And you're a specialized CPA, CFO. When I was ranching, what I loved about it is it fed my value system that was innate. It wasn't a chosen value system. It was inherited. And the value system was busy, be busy. Just be busy, be productive. And so when I took on a project, I would take on another and another and another. And pretty soon you'd be managing 12 projects. You're juggling and you're probably not getting ahead on any one of them. And you start taking shortcuts. And this plays well with my ADHD. I mean, my ADHD loves to start new projects. And I don't know if a damn one of them ever got finished. Certainly not to the specifications of an outsourced contractor that they would have done a better job fencing than I had, certainly. But I felt like I had value because I'm so busy, Todd. I've got all this going on. I can't even stop to go to the bathroom. That type of personality, I think, plays well on farms and ranches. The owner operator maverick, you're not going to tell me what to do. Sitting down to do this enterprise analysis, to take time where I have to focus, that is as overwhelming as a 5-paragraph email. That'll sit in my inbox for probably 2 or 3 months before I even want to open it and start on the first paragraph, Todd.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And, my work is primarily encouraging clients to just start the process of disciplining themselves to spend an hour or two a month. That's not a huge ask, thinking about some of these things. And I'm gonna help you walk you through that. And the things that I want to talk about are the first thing we want to look at is what's your financial plan for your farm or ranch for this year, broken out by enterprise. How much is your cow calf enterprise going to make versus your yearling enterprise versus your hay enterprise versus your freezer beef enterprise versus selling some replacement heifers. And the truth is that nobody really knows. Very, very few people have any data about that. We start by putting that farm plan in place or ranch plan in place. And I need to know what are your enterprises. We have to identify what those are. And then we have to figure out, how do we take all of your costs and allocate them fairly to the right enterprise? And honestly, because all of us have our pet projects that we really don't want to know if they're not making us any money. And so not everybody wants that at this level of accountability.
I don't necessarily want to see the facts and the data.
Yeah, right. Right. A lot of people don't. My practice is based on the people that want to not only the first thing is they're motivated to never be in a position where they have to sell their ranch or their farm. That's a multi-generational asset. They're managing it in trust as a steward for future generations. However, they're in a marketplace where they're raising a commodity and they're competing against other people who are willing to jeopardize their long-term ownership in order to subsidize their operating business. That's just the brutal reality of ranching.
Absolutely.
Subsidizing
with cheap labor.
Yeah. If you're going to succeed and survive, you have to have an unfair advantage. The number one unfair advantage in ranching is thinking about it like a business and making your operating business cash flow. If we can get that done, then you're very likely to be able to pass on the land to the next generation.
And that is a recurring conversation with, especially, so I'm 36 and my generation, who are now transitioning to decision makers. Some won't be a decision maker until they're 66, but some are.
Yep. That's right.
And the chief concern is, oh my gosh, how do we buy more land and make the P&I with cattle? And my feedback is always, you never will. So
correct.
Focus on the operating margins of your depreciating assets, of the operating entity.
Mm-hmm.
Tractors, cows, people. That's focus on the profits you can drive from there, because the land is out of reach today. It will always be out of reach.
Right.
Accept that and figure out how you make a more profitable business out of the operating entity.
Correct. And to do that, you have to be able to produce some kind of an accounting plan. You got to have some kind of a plan that says each of these enterprises are going to be able to do this. So at a very basic level, a ranch is in the business of growing forage. And the enterprises tell me, one, how much forage am I growing? And two, what's the highest and best use of that forage to monetize it, to turn it into the highest value in a way that doesn't impair the long-term long-term land ownership. So, I've advocated for years that I don't want my clients to devote any more than about 60% of their forage base to cows, because we're already emotionally attached to our ranch and to our heritage. We get emotionally attached to our cows, and so you will not sell cows soon enough in a drought. Versus yearlings.
That's if you because have some yearlings, you can't buy this herd, Todd.
I know everybody's heard the same way. You can't buy this, and that's true. You can't. There is incredible value in having an adapted cow herd that you've picked over the years. And the number one way you can preserve that cow herd is making absolutely sure that you don't feed any more than 60% of your forage to those cows. Buy some stockers or retain ownership of your calves as yearlings, because you're not sacrificing that gene pool in a drought. And what everybody does that has 110% of their forage base is devoted to their cows because they're a little overstocked, is you get a drought year and you hold on to those cows hoping it's going to rain, and it doesn't. And then now you've damaged your future grass growing capacity. You've permanently negatively impacted your carrying capacity, and you're going to sell the cows anyway. And you're going to have to go a lot deeper than just 60%, than just 40% of your herd at that point.
And that plays well into a University of Wyoming study, long-term study, that for drought planning and market volatility markets, 60-40, 60% cow-calf, 40% stockers.
Mm-hmm.
Is what they show the optimal blend is. And then that also kind of plays well into, I forget the books, the consultants who talk about two-thirds leased, one-third deeded.
That's
kind of your mix.
That's also, that's a good, that's, in my opinion, that's the way that you optimize. The other thing that does is you're a lot closer to being able to dabble with some freezer beef options. You want to do grass-fed beef, you want to do some grain-fed beef, you want to try to do some direct marketing, you want to supply some cattle for a premium program like the Audubon program that I source cattle for. In fact, we just we're bringing some cows from Montana end of this month back to Minnesota for processing for a pilot project for a very large beef buyer that has asked us to source cows from Audubon certified ranches.
Well, let's get into that, because I earlier mentioned I wanted to had a couple more grass fed. It seems like since you started and you were the anomaly, the outlier, that you had a successful grass fed program. For every one of you, there's 40 who could not make it work. They've come and gone, and it also seems like it's a Hail Mary like, oh gosh, yeah. You know, we can,
right.
If we start a grass fed direct to consumer local beef, we could probably buy the neighbor's ranch. And why don't I get my millennial daughter-in-law to run this? Where do people go wrong? Why has it been?
Well, couple of reasons. One is that most people don't have access to a processor that can do wet aging and cryovac, and they can't sell a fresh program. The second thing is that just because you don't feed grain to your cattle doesn't make it a good eating experience. The vast majority of people that are selling grass-fed beef on a whole carcass basis and killing those animals at a custom locker where they're killing them and hanging them for 10 days to 2 weeks and then freezing them immediately are not producing a great eating experience. They're not going to get repeat customers.
Does Autobahn call it a value add, another program? Does programming up help at all? I mean, we can program up with NHTC and GAP5. Yeah, right. And
yep.
And I've definitely heard over the last 3 years with crazy beef prices that programming up doesn't pay. But what is the risk differentiating factor there for Autobahn? I'm not familiar with the program. I only remember the Autobahn guy getting grilled at the WSE event.
Yeah, right. Right. So let's talk about generalities first. So there's a cattle cycle, you know, 1 to 2 years out of 10, calves are worth a bunch. Those years, the premiums don't help you. But the premiums really do put a floor in the value of cattle on the down years in the cattle cycle. And there's more down years than up years. That's the way the cycle works. And that just gets back to what we talked about at the beginning. You know, the emotional drive to own cows is not subject to the traditional economic signals of supply and demand. The only thing that slows down the desire to own cows is drought. Now, it remains to be seen. You know, my pet theory is that all these guys that have a desperate need to own ranches and cows all grew up watching Gunsmoke and Roy Rogers. And
absolutely.
So I don't know if that is done with that generation, or if it's more instinctual and harder wired in there.
I think it's gone threefold from Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and John Wayne. I think Taylor Sheridan has taken,
I agree. There's a whole new generation now.
Yeah.
Yep. Right.
Taylor Sheridan has taken the spaghetti Western and made it threefold.
Yep. I would tend to agree. I don't think that's going to go away. I think the desired, and it was never any different. I mean, if you look at the way at the ownership pattern of large ranches in the late 1800s, in the mid 1800s, there were Easterners that owned all the ranches. The cowboys did the work, but very relatively few acres were owned by operators. It was an asset class, no different than it's considered today. And you have to understand that history. If you simply cannot retain ownership of large-scale ranch land for multiple generations if you don't really understand what drives the decision that other people who have way more money than you do what compels them to go buy a ranch out a long ways away from where that it's so far removed from anything they've ever done in their life. Why is that? And it's so unique. It doesn't happen in any other industry. You don't have in any other industry people that don't know anything about it that are just compelled to invest their money in it. You have to understand that the psychology behind that phenomenon if you're going to succeed as a multi-generational rancher.
If you're a multi-generational rancher, is it time to go so you can either scale or niche, differentiate niche or scale. multi-generational ranchers, is it time to consider partners such as the Autobahn? And what is that?
Yeah,
what
well, that look I, like? I think, yes. So you're either going to have to drive more income per ton of grass, or you have to go acquire control of more grass. And the problem with acquiring control of more grass, as you've already illustrated, is that you're bidding against people that don't need, they don't pay for that grass with what the grass they can make from it in the future. They made their money doing something that has nothing to do with grass, and they're redeploying that wealth into buying control of grass. You cannot outbid them. So what you have to do is you have to get a lot more creative. How do I, one, use the grass, the acres I have, to grow twice as much grass? Everybody can do that in 5 years with just change in management. Two, how do I get more value out of the grass that I grow? And that's going to mean getting closer to the consumer. If you're raising calves and selling wean calves, you're a long ways from the consumer. And even if you're Audubon certified or certified organic or GAP 5, so many other things have to be done right to retain that value in that wean calf by the time it gets on somebody's plate, that there's relatively a very small percentage of the end consumer premium paid ends up back at you because you're just a long ways from them. If you can take that animal to 900 pound yearling, you get a bigger chunk of the premium because you're closer now. If you take that animal all the way to a finish weight, whether that's grass-fed or grain-fed, you're now in a position to ask for a greater percentage of that consumer premium. And if you are involved in the processing, so that doesn't mean you have to own the processor, but you have the capacity to produce not a live animal, but a packaged product. Well, now you can command an even greater premium, and you know, ultimately, if you're selling directly to your eater, and you're not going through a retail store or a restaurant or a distributor, then you get all of the premium. So, but each one of those things requires developing additional skills, and in most cases, they're people skills and they're abstract skills. And if you don't have somebody on your team, in your family or hired, that wakes up in the morning and can't wait to go solve people problems, you shouldn't start a business that requires expertise in solving people problems to succeed. So I did this at WSE, and I asked everybody to raise their hand, you know, who wants to solve feed and cattle problems, and everybody raised their hand. And who wants to solve people problems? Well, nobody wants to solve.
Hell no! That's why I'm a rancher. Leave me alone.
That's exactly right.
With others.
No, and that's the other thing that we have to be realistic about is that multi-generational ranchers have self-selected against people. People, the people left. They didn't even try to come west. It's very hard to succeed at that because we're not with the right personality.
Yeah, that man, a lot plays into that because you just presented another new culture that the antisocial personalities went west.
Right.
And I've always said that it's also the peasants of Europe. So if I'm fifth generation, 1883 is when, you know, my legacy came over from Friesland, the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They didn't leave a killer business.
No, exactly. They didn't leave because they had lots of options there.
Yeah. And that type of mentality of scarcity traveled with them. And then that type of mentality of scarcity, kind of peasant living on the margins, make do with what you have, that got passed down generationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still really strong.
Yeah. Well, Todd, I need the elevator pitch for the Autobahn certification.
All right. So Autobahn certification is, in my opinion, the easiest way to explore adding value to your cattle by using a third-party certification. For a couple reasons. One is that it was written by ranchers for ranchers, and it requires the least dumb thing. You have to do the fewest dumb things to be qualified, because it's not really, it's primarily focused on bird habitat, and there's a tremendous overlap in all the things that you want to do to create bird habitat or all the things that you want to do to double the forage production on your ranch. And so there's virtually nothing in that protocol that you wouldn't want to do, even if you don't care about bird habitat. If you just want to double your grass production and your carrying capacity. Now, it doesn't really matter. You know, if you talk to Audubon, the primary benefit is the bird habitat. The secondary benefit is the additional forage production. If you talk to a rancher, I think it's the other way around. My primary objective is to double my grass. If I can do that in a way that I also end up creating bird habitat, that's a great serendipity. I like birds. And if I can get some sort of premium at some point in the future for that, great. Because I'm not actually spending more money. I'm not doing things that I wouldn't otherwise do economically in order to get this certification. So, and I think that's different than all of the other ones. Certainly different than certified organic. It's different than 100% grass-fed. It's different than GAP, where I'm deliberately not doing things that I would otherwise likely do. That's a good entry point.
As a good old boy operator, and I'll be mindful of your time, and we'll wrap it up here pretty quick, Todd. In my mind, as the good old boy operator, you're asking me to change, and with change comes perceived risk. And in my mind, I'm kind of going through that risk quadrant. There are known knowns, unknown knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns.
Right.
And so who bears the risk in this? What is the risk? And am I going to be compensated for that?
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's a great question. And because the Audubon program didn't start with a marketer, it didn't start with somebody saying, hey, the customer will pay me a 30% premium. Well, and that's how I started Thousand Hills. The customers want 100% grass-fed, no antibiotics, no hormones. All right. What do I have to do to induce a rancher and to retain ownership of those calves, keep them around, feed them, don't feed them any grain, and ship them to me when they're 1,300 pounds? And what am I going to have to pay to induce that person to do that? Because that's not really in their best interest economically. So the conversation is always centered around the premium has to be big enough to justify my lost opportunity cost or my additional expenses. Audubon's just the other way around. There's nothing that Audubon is asking you to do that is going to require you to spend more money. In fact, all Audubon is asking you to do is to change your mindset about a number of things. As an example, when you mow a hayfield, don't mow the headlands first and work your way in, because then you trap all the birds and kill them. Mm-hmm. Start in the middle and work your way out. All the birds get flushed out to the edges. Never thought of that, but it makes perfect sense. And it doesn't actually cost me anything. It's a minor irritation the first couple times I do it. And then it just becomes natural.
Yeah, I don't want to virtue signal any here, but I tried not to chop up as many birds and baby deer as I could when I was mowing.
Yeah,
hay.
Of course.
As I was listening to Kick the Hay Habit by Jim
right, Garish, by Jim Garish.
Pissed off about what I was doing.
Yep, right, exactly. That is exactly right. So I guess final plug, you know, obviously I'm a rancher philosopher, and we've mostly talked about my philosophies about ranching, but what I love to do is help my clients develop the accounting systems that give us data to support these philosophical conversations. And we use figures a great tool to do that. If you don't want to do any of the accounting, you can outsource all of it to us. I'm actually going to be out in Livingston, February 20th and 21st, teaching at financial fundamentals for ranching school that WSE is putting on. They haven't really announced it yet, but hold the date on your calendar for that. That's going to be really fun. And we're going to dig into all this stuff then over those 2 days.
Well, I will put it in the show notes. I think we'll also link it to your website, but so it makes it to the transcriber and show notes to this. How can people get in touch with you, reach out to you, learn more? What's your contact info? Where to go next?
Contact info is todd.churchill, CHURCHILL, at claconnect.com. If you just, you can find me on LinkedIn at Todd Churchill. You can Google me, Todd Churchill, Thousand Hills, and find all kinds of videos of all kinds of stuff I've done speaking in the past. I'm easy to find. Google knows everything about me.
Well, thanks for coming on, and I appreciate your time. And if there's anything I can help you with in the future, be a resource, I'd like to repay the opportunity.
I want to talk to you more about the syndication approach that you're working on for ranch ownership, because I work with a lot of people that are new to ranch ownership. They want to own a ranch. They're going to buy one, but they don't know what they're doing. And I think there's tremendous opportunities to bring a little more thoughtfulness to that whole piece of this.
I was actually going to stop the recording, but tell you, I'd like to send you the PPM.
Yeah, great. Would love to take a look at it.
Get your thoughts on the draft.
Yep. Sounds good.
Thanks, Todd. We'll be in touch on that.
All right.
Have a good weekend.
Great visiting. Thanks
for tuning into the Ranch Investor Podcast. We at Ranch Investor are very interested in hearing your thoughts, your opinion, your wants, desires, hopes, and dreams, everything on ranch syndications, ranch investment, ranch real estate syndications, and DPPs, direct participation programs. Please reach out.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped. Be the source of knowledge and the maven that other professionals are excited to refer.